You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
I wanted to start with the settlement with Moriori over their claims for redress. Let's start generally. What does the settlement say?
Like all settlements, there's a number of aspects to it. They get compensation of $18 million, the financial compensation. They get a number of, or they get a wee bit of land returned to them. They get a lot more acknowledgements of other landmarks as of significance to them. A lot of areas and little settlements on the islands will now have a Moriori name attached to them. So the New Zealand Geographic Board now allows kind of multiple names. So there'll be an English and Moriori and Mutunga, which is the other iwi on the islands, names attached to various places. There's commitments in terms of relationships with government departments, principally Department of Internal Affairs and DOC, who are the big departments on those islands. I think the most important thing for them too was the historical account and an acknowledgement of what had happened and how the Crown had failed Moriori when they were enslaved on those islands.
Yeah, absolutely. The nature of colonisation in our country means that acknowledgement of them as wānapono of the area, it involves debunking pervasive myths among Pākehā, which have stood in the way of exactly what you were just recognising for decades now. Does this settlement entail measures for that culturally?
Yeah, I mean, Moriori have been, they've done an amazing job really in the last 40 years of getting scholarship to support their story, their history, and they've had published works. Michael King was, I think, the first. There have been others since. And they had, there is now an accurate story about Moriori when they arrived on the islands and what happened to them from 1835 onwards. So, and one of the roles as a minister I play at the deed signing ceremony is to make the apology that has been agreed upon, and the nature of the apology is not, it's not just a bland, gee, we're sorry all that's happened to you. I actually go through the various aspects of the Crown's failing and apologise for each of those aspects. And it's actually, and I have to say, when we did this last Friday, more than any other I've done, it was actually quite an emotional process to go through, and where we were on this marae, we had this, they had this marae that they built in 2005, and at the centre of it is this big po with 1,600 names of Moriori who perished during this period of enslavement and being killed, and you suddenly realise what you're doing and what you're acknowledging and who you were speaking to when you go through this account of what happened to them and how the Crown failed them, and it was very moving and emotional, and I think it's those sorts of things that start to help the healing when the Crown actually fronts up and shows a demonstration of the significance of what has happened to them. And I think that stuff's very, very important.
Yeah. As you say, just because there has been a settlement now doesn't mean that any of the mai mai, the hurt around that, will suddenly disappear. How do you think this particular aspect of the relationship will be upheld and supported from now on?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like all settlements, you're right. You get to agreement about what went wrong and you get agreement about some redress. But really, it's what happens after that. It's the future relationship that's critical. And what the treaty settlement should do is lay a foundation for that future relationship. And I think if Moriori go into the future of the relationship, understanding that the Crown accepts what their failings were, what they did, and what caused harm to their people, that's a very powerful starting point. And then I think you build on that in terms of the future decision-making about the islands that they get engaged in.
One opportunity for that will be, obviously, your government has made a policy for our history being taught in schools now. Do you think that the true stories of Moriori will start to be told when this policy becomes in place, so that the recognition of their position of wānapono becomes widespread?
Yeah, totally. Now, I think because there has been, in the last 40 years, there's been some really robust scholarship now about the account about what happened to Moriori. That said, I have to say Ngāti Mutunga, who is the iwi on the island, they have interested. They do have a different view. I mean, they were the ones who subjugated Moriori. They have a different view, and they have felt somewhat affronted about the historical accounts that have emerged.
Okay.
And fairness to them, I mean, they're not, they don't, they, although they found it difficult, they haven't sort of being obstructive about it, but they want their story told as well, and we're working with them to make sure that they get a story told. They were harmed by the Crown's actions as well at the time of colonisation, so we have to acknowledge that. But we have to work with them so they tell their story, so that their mana is restored, but without cutting across clearly the harm caused to Māori Audi as well. This has been one of the most interesting and I think probably more tense sets of negotiations as a minister I've been involved in, because of these sort of somewhat competing views, not so much about what happened, but the motivations for what happened on those islands, Rekohu for the Māori Audi, or Wharekauri for Mutunga. But we're making reasonably good progress with Mutunga. We haven't got their signature on a piece of paper yet, but I hope that we're close to that.
Mm. So moving on, I wanted to ask you, before we go into this next topic, why the legal right to silence is essential?
It's a protection for the innocent. So we have, we have state agencies and principally the police have pretty extraordinary powers, powers of arrest, powers to detain, powers to sit you in a room and ask you questions. And so over many years, we've built up these protections so that if you're innocent, then you can't be prevailed upon by those with these extraordinary powers. Mm. So that's what that's about. And also it means that for the police, if they're going to exercise their powers of, particularly to detain you and ask you questions, then they have to have a reasonably firm foundation to do so. So reasonable grounds to suspect that you've committed an offence, as opposed to sort of plucking people out who there might be some sort of hunch or suspicion. And given in this day and age the greater awareness we have of conscious or unconscious bias or racism, these protections are actually quite important. So. Yeah. That's what it's there for. These are protections for the innocent. And I know that when we get situations where something truly horrific has happened, and particularly in this, the issues at the moment with a little infant boy who's clearly been brutalised, we want people who did that to be called to account and held responsible. But we've just got to remember that you've got to have a basis to raise that suspicion first. And we shouldn't be eroding that. Otherwise, we just become a totalitarian state.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, all week you've been dealing with media responses to other parliamentarians positing that this law is a problem standing in the way of dealing with child abuse in New Zealand. But is the law the key reason that perpetrators of child abuse slide under the radar?
Family violence and particularly child abuse are endemic in New Zealand. We do seem to have a major problem compared to other kind of Western countries. So, of course, we all understand how everybody feels appalled and outraged and deeply upset by it, and we all are. But we've got to be careful that in our emotions that we feel about something like this, that we don't demand instant responses that end up compromising a whole heap of other very important values that, in a different set of circumstances, could cause more harm to other people. Mm. So it's that constant balancing, and we've got to do it. And look, there have been some interviews with me about it and quite kind of reactionary starting points from the people posing questions to me, but my obligation and my view as Minister of Justice is I've got to stand by a set of core values for our justice system, however difficult that might be, and not kind of get into knee-jerk reactions, because we're also horrified about this one instance that has happened on this occasion.
Non-disclosure of child abuse was made punishable by up to 10 years incarceration back in 2011 by one of the same parties making the same calls again now. So what's your response to this sort of disparity?
Yeah, I think Judith Collins, when she was minister, she did introduce a law in a similar sort of situation. Child had been abused horrifically, and they focused on the obligation to provide care for a child, and she did a law. It's resulted in about 25 people being charged under it, most of whom were convicted. I think she pitched it about right. They had another opportunity later, as recently as 2017, where they were looking at mandatory disclosure. And it wasn't just for teachers and social workers and others. It was for anybody who became aware that a child was at risk or subject to abuse. The original draft law was that they would have been obliged to disclose, and if they didn't, there would have been a criminal penalty if they didn't.
Mm.
Well, the National Party backed out of that, and they said, oh, no, you can't do that. Can't make it mandatory and criminalise it. That'd create more problems than it would fix. So they made it discretionary. So if you do suspect something, you can report it, and providing you do so in good faith, then you won't be liable for having reported it. So that's as far as they went. I think that's about as far as you could go without getting into overreach and getting into more kind of autocratic approaches. And I think we've just got to keep focused on. And in the end, it's about doing what works, what's going to keep kids safe. I think from this government's point of view, and certainly from my point of view, prevention is the most important thing. And supporting families in distress, making sure that support services are there, where we know where there are families and particularly children at risk. And I know they don't get a good press these days, but Oranga Tamariki have a vital role to play in that. They come under criticism. Some of it's justified. Some of it I don't think is. We've got to make sure that Oranga Tamariki isn't put in a position where they get fearful about intervening in difficult situations because somebody's going to call foul on it, even though their actions might be justified. And this is the difficult environment that we're in when you're dealing with families and those very deeply intimate, personal sort of situations that people can be at risk in, and we've got to have effective interventions for.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.